So thank you, Daniel, for the invitation. Thank you all for being here. This is my first visit to the Perimeter Institute, even though I'm not based too far away. I appreciate it. So hopefully I can interest you with this talk about the alignment of research directions in quantum computing and light dark matter searches. I am in the management at SnowLab, so I'm going to give a few slides on what SnowLab is, just in case some of you aren't familiar. I feel obligated to do so.
You've got a chip in your neck right there.
Then I'll discuss light dark matter searches, at least my take on it in this context, a little bit about how that connects to quantum science and technology, swing back to particle physics and talk about future directions, and then final thought. So I do want to acknowledge that at SnowLab, we share the land with those who came before us. SnowLab's located on the traditional territory of the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850, shared by the indigenous people of the surrounding Atikamekw-Sheng Anishinaabeg First Nation as part of the larger Anishinaabeg Nation. We acknowledge those who came before us and honor those who are caretakers of the land and water. That is, you know, I think it's very important for SnowLab to continue acknowledging the land, because we sit on a very industrial place that is sort of at the heart of some of the issues that came before us in terms of settling the lands here. That acknowledging this does not solve the problem, but we just acknowledge that that exists and we are part of it. So SnowLab itself, we host rare event searches and measurements. We're located 2 kilometers underground in the active Vallée Creighton nickel mine near Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. This is one of the most productive areas on the planet in terms of nickel, top 10 mines on the planet for nickel, which comes with its challenges and its advantages. It's nice to have a company making $1 million of profit a day operating our access, so they are very good at maintaining access to our laboratory.
The same location as you don't have a separate, the labs are exactly the same location.
Same entrance, right?
Same entrance as the mine.
Same shaft we take down with the miners.
Really miners, a bunch of scrawny little business,
right? Something like that, yeah. And we have to wear the same coveralls that they wear, the high-vis coveralls. And you can tell the scientists because they're just pristine and clean, and the miners that are just covered in dirt. But yes. I did look it up. It's about a 4.5 hour drive from Perimeter Institute. We're operated as a joint trust with 5 main universities, Alberta, Carleton, Laurentian, Montreal, and Queen's. And our operations are largely funded by the province of Ontario and the CFI. Okay. I have to say, SnowLab has the lowest available muon flux. So in terms of laboratories, we are the deepest if your measure of depth is muon rates. So there is a Chinese lab, Jinping Lab, which is technically has more rock over it, but it's inside of a mountain. So if you count muons, they actually have a slightly higher rate. And I like to quote, this is the measurement from the Jinping Lab. So they're the ones who have stated that SnowLab's slightly lower. These, of course, are statements about competition. We also have a clean room throughout the underground facility. So this makes it easy to deploy particularly small-scale experiments. You don't have to build a dedicated clean room. You just take them, put them down, and start taking data, which has made us attractive to a number of experiments, particularly low-mass dark matter projects, which are smaller, typically, and they've been able to deploy relatively quickly. This is a picture of what the underground campus looks like. Let's see, for those of you online, I'll try to use this cursor. Let's see. Okay, so normally when you access the mine, you come to the top of the mine where all the miners congregate in the morning. We typically take the cage down at about 6:30 in the morning, and then we walk for about 1.5 kilometers to the laboratory entrance right around here. This is where we start spraying down our boots. We have separate locker rooms for the different genders. We undress, we take a shower, we dress in clean room gear, and then this square here and this somewhat oval-shaped area, these are all clean room spaces. It's about like a large shopping mall, about 5,000 square meters. And you can see some of the details in terms of particle counts. And if you want to see what a day is like at SnowLab, I recommend looking at our videos on YouTube. We have some of the digits for some of our larger caverns in terms of their sizes, if you're interested. Underground science is actually still rising quite quickly in the world. I think this plot that I have here sort of shows this history of underground science really starting to explode in the 1990s and continues to this day. A lot of that's driven by neutrino science, but also dark matter science as well. I'm hoping to break up this histogram into the different fields, but haven't gotten that far yet. In terms of Snow, and that's all underground science. In terms of SnowLab itself, we have about 1,000 users from 24 countries, 128 institutions, and our staff size is about 140 employees. In terms of the science that we're focused on at SnowLab, we're primarily looking at furthering the investigation of the nature of matter. So specifically, we've been looking at what is the nature of dark matter, what are neutrinos, how do neutrinos interact. So those are our big flagship projects. And then beyond that, we're also interested in collaborating really on any scientific research that requires deep underground facilities. So we do have neutrino observatories. We do have a project that's looking at the effects of radiation on biological systems, trying to show that sub-background radiation levels. So if you're in an environment with less radiation than we have in this room, then that could be bad for you. And so they've been successful in getting interest from the nuclear power industry because we're showing that radiation is good for you. So the idea is that we haven't done a lot of research in sub-background effects on biological systems. The idea is that we have evolved to actually rely on this background of ionizing radiation for, let's say, repair mechanisms in our cells, that we need this constant mutation to actually repair our cells from damage, is the idea that they're testing. There's also, we're starting to get a couple of projects in environmental monitoring, and there we're focused on nuclear non-proliferation. We have lower backgrounds in SnowLab, so we can better detect isotopes of interest to things like the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, for example. We can also age date things, so we have lower backgrounds. So for certain isotopes, we can get better age dating measurements. And so that's where I'm talking about aquifers. And then the effects of radiation on quantum technologies, which I'll focus on in this talk.
What's the closest reactor to the site?
It's on the Bruce Peninsula, so it's a few hundred kilometers away. I don't know if you've noticed in the news, but SnowPlus actually made a bunch of physics news for detecting the neutrinos from Bruce and Darlington reactor just using pure water, which was the first time that was done with pure water. And we hope to have actually, SnowPlus now is full of scintillator, so oil-based scintillator. We hope to have the best theta-1-2 measurement from those reactors as well. We can actually, because of the locations, we can actually see oscillations in the spectrum that they'll detect at SnowPlus.
So no one wants the source inside of SnowPlus.
Can you see Chalk River 2, or are they no longer running a reactor?
They're not running anything at the scale of Bruce or Darlington, so we can't see them. I think they're still running a test reactor there, but it must be tens of megawatts, whereas, these gigawatt things are what they can really see. And with Bruce and Darlington, the rate is about, it's like one a month is something, the rate that we're getting.
Is it going to go up? Because I always hear Canada is like the land of the future of nuclear reactors. Is the number of nuclear reactors going up?
Is the number of nuclear reactors going to go up in Canada? I don't know. I hope so. Yeah. And this is me being editorializing. I think with the movement towards electric cars, we have an electricity generation problem. And I think the concept that just came out for Ontario to produce that by burning natural gas is not farsighted.
Right now, we have hydro and nuclear mostly.
Yes. We have nuclear and hydro right now. I agree. Okay.
I'd be interested to know where you heard that, though. Why are we in the future?
I always hear this everywhere that Canada is the country with the most number of nuclear reactors in construction.
Oh, is that true? It's not China. China was that with 14.
Yeah, right.
Black.
China.
I thought the Chinese were that.
Wow.
Anyway, depends on.
I am no expert on that, so I will stop editorializing. Okay, so dark matter. I'm sure you all understand this, but many of our WIMP dark matter searches focused on, say, the 100G, and I started in dark matter searches in 2007, so that's my perspective. It's about 15 plus years working on dark matter searches, so just so you know where I'm arguing from. So traditionally, at least a decade ago or two decades ago, we were all looking for the WIMP, which was going to be at exactly 100 GeV, and this was due to the WIMP miracle, where if you do some numerology, you will get, and some reasonable numerology, you will calculate the right annihilation cross-section for 100 GeV WIMP with a weak scale annihilation cross-section. Now, if you're looking for a 100 GeV particle that is neutral, it will likely scatter off of nucleons and give KeV nuclear recoils. So this is the signal we've been looking at for a few decades now. And SNOLAB itself hosts many dark matter experiments. The idea is you have some sort of WIMP particle. It's going at, say, 200 kilometers a second, or the Earth is going at 200 kilometers a second, but in the lab frame, the WIMP is going at this speed, has some sort of interaction with some sort of material in the laboratory, and gives a nuclear recoil. If we have 100 GeV WIMP, we expect 1 to 100 KeV recoils, just from conservation of momentum. And this has been hugely successful. So one of the enabling technologies has been the rare event detection techniques of reducing backgrounds. So if you talk to a dark matter experimentalist, they will talk your ear off all day about searching for smaller and smaller amounts of dirt, because that's basically what we do, is try to get all of the dirt out of our experiments. And we've been very successful at that. This plot I like to show, this is a plot from 1987, actually, from one of the first double beta decay and dark matter experiments, IJEX, talking about reducing backgrounds. And if you can look at this plot, backgrounds in certain energy ranges have been reduced by well over two orders of magnitude with the work they're doing. And here they I love the title of this talk, The Impact of Natural Radioactivity in Solder on Low Background Experiments. So this is dirt in solder, where they reduced the backgrounds significantly, you can see on the right-hand side of the plot, by over an order of magnitude just by changing out the solder they used. Anyway, most of the dark matter projects, so they reverse engineer the background rates required by designing a project that has a certain sensitivity to a certain interaction strength, and then looking to create backgrounds such that you get less than one event per year per experiment. That is the goal in all of these dark matter experiments. And they've been very successful at doing this. This is just a short history from this review of dark matter projects. And this doesn't cover the entire 15 years of my history in this field. This is more recent, but you can see that we've been, this is a log plot with many orders of magnitude. You can see that we've been pushing down in sensitivity. And does anybody need an explanation of these plots? I figure you're all pretty familiar. Yeah. Sorry?
We want you to explain to us gamma.
I tried doing that. I'll show you later.
That's why
we did CDMS light. Yeah. So I worked on CDMS, was to test a specific gamma hypothesis.
Can I ask you,
So
this is actually quite impressive because it's like 10 orders of magnitude in the cross sections, which is extremely cool. So Where did most of this come from? Is it basically background rejection, building bigger? So what is it? Or is it a combination? Can you, like...
It is scaling up while controlling that background to one event per year per experiment. So building larger experiments, but keeping that specification of one event per year. And that basic concept has allowed us to go many orders of magnitude in sensitivity.
Okay.
we've gotten very good at finding dirt in everything.
You do and you learn. This is how experience.
Yes, yes. And I will say, being at SnowLab, that underground infrastructure was required to make this achievable. So it's really the cosmic muons that have required us to have a very thick shield of 2 kilometers to reduce the backgrounds down to these levels. Okay.
You went to one of your competitor labs. Can they get down into other ways to this rate of one background event per year? Or is that something which only you guys can do?
No, so that is not actually the most restrictive background requirement on the muons. So some of the more successful experiments are at shallower labs. So the big 100 GeV experiments, there's LZ, there's one in China called Panda X, there's Dark Side at Gran Sasso, but many of these are at Gran Sasso where the muon rates are about a factor of 100 higher. But they are able to reject those and reduce those. Actually, where the background requirements are even more stringent and they're starting to run into the muon levels at some of the shallower depths is neutrinoless double beta decay. So there, the most sensitive experiment, actually more than half of their background is from muons coming in and causing spallation events on the actual target nucleus of xenon. So Camlan Zen 800, more than half of their background is from cosmic radiation. So that is the first real, particle physics experiment that I think in a deep lab that's limited by cosmic radiation in the deep lab. So it is starting to matter in the neutrinoless double beta decay, but for dark matter, we have other advantages. So the ease of deploying in just a monolithic clean room, for example, has attracted many users. So we are definitely deep enough for dark matter searches, but you could be shallower, but you definitely need to be underground. The original CDMS, which was at Stanford, was 30 feet underground, and that was limited by cosmic rays there. So that's when they went to Sudan in northern Minnesota, and now we're building at SnowLab. Okay, so as you may have heard, we did not find the 100 GeV WIMP.
Not yet.
It could still be there. It could interact with matter so faintly that it's never detectable.
Well, this kind of, it's like xenodark matter is still alive.
Yes.
It's just your...
It could be undetectable. It could be buried in the neutrino backgrounds. Yes. This is the curse of being a dark matter experimentalist. You choose one hypothesis amongst the sea of hypotheses, and you spend your life testing it.
Still was a good one. Don't doubt that.
Oh, it is a good one still. You're right. But I think the community has broadened their interest from this single hypothesis. I think some of the theorists have found other mechanisms to create lower mass dark matter particles. When I was in graduate school, I learned this speech that I was taught. This is how you talk about the lower limit, is that LEP has ruled out any WIMP below 30 GeV, and that is no longer the speech that we give anymore. Okay, so for light dark matter, I'm talking about mega electron volts to giga electron volts in terms of particle mass. You can see that this plot is from the most recent SnowMass process, and you can see the community has a lot of ambition to go from where current constraints are to really expand that across a broad range of masses, including axion searches, which are quite interesting, as well as searching for WIMPs or WIMP-like particles down at lower masses. I just wanted to show this, that indeed we were trying to search for low-mass WIMPs down to 1 GeV, and I've been interested in this topic since about 2008. Talking about picking a hypothesis and chasing it for over a decade. Okay, so what are the implications of looking for lighter particles? Well, as your particles get below the proton mass, that's why I chose a GeV in my abstract earlier, the conservation of momentum is a cruel partner. So once you go to something like 100 mega electron volts is the particle mass, an order of magnitude below the proton mass, you start to get signals which are undetectable below an electron volt. So we're talking about milli electron volt signals, which is our experimental challenge for light dark matter. Okay. Now, ionizing radiation detectors themselves, and I love getting this deep into experiments at a place like Perimeter. So this is detector theory, experimental theory. So most technologies are, especially today, are based on the ionization gap in materials. So there is some energy, and we were just talking about the lack of UV photons from the sun. The EV scale is something like a temperature of 10,000 or so. So excitations from, say, neutral atoms to ions and electrons, that doesn't happen at room temperature. Nuclear and particle physics were spawned largely from efforts to understand why the air carries a current. So there is ionization in air. It shouldn't happen at these temperatures. Why does it happen? Nuclear and particle physics. Even when we go to our physics department and learn physics, you know, we've split things into ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. So those are the two courses, at least at the University of Utah, in terms of detecting radiation. And this happens at the EV scale, because this is really the scale of most ionization. And this is a fundamental energy threshold limitation for detectors and for light dark matter searches. Because you must, if you believe that your signals in nature are quantized, if energy is quantized, if these signals are quantized in this way, then you have to have at least one to say you have more than zero. So that's your fundamental threshold. You must always have at least one to say you had something at all. My theoretical observations are simple. So dark matter detectors have achieved this for ionization detection. This is a nice plot that I like to show from Super CDMS. So this is the detection rate, and this is a function of energy, but here they're counting in electron hole pairs. And you can see they have a threshold that's well below one electron hole pair, which again, I pointed out in 2008. With high voltage, we could start to detect, we could have thresholds below a single electron hole pair. And we were able to achieve it 10 years later. And CDMS isn't the only technology that's tackling this and achieving this. So certainly Skipper CCDs have achieved this. Proportional counters have long been able to see single quanta. Liquid noble TPCs are looking at this. Scintillators, they're not looking at ionization, but they can certainly detect single photons. And these technologies, looking in this parameter space, is so new that these small tabletop experiments, just proving the technology on the surface, unshielded, have sensitivity to unexplored parameter space. So just having the theoretical insights that these particles could exist, we've created the technologies, and we are probing unexplored parameter space. Now this is the end of the road for ionization detectors. This is the end of the road for ionizing dark matter. Lighter dark matter than what can be detected by this will require fundamentally new technologies, or at least lower band gaps. So I know there are ideas to say dope CCDs with impurities, which have a smaller band gap, which can be ionized with lower amounts of energy. But that's an example of the ideas that are in the space to try to get a smaller band gap so that you can start to detect lower mass dark matter. Are you just thinking, or are you confused?
Those are the same thing.
That's true.
I'm not confused by what you said.
You're not confused by what I said. Okay, good. Okay, so that brings us to superconductors. Now, I'm using superconductors because I've worked with superconducting technology for some time now. There are other interesting technologies that offer smaller band gaps. But I use this as an example. And it connects with quantum computing very directly. So counting quasi-particles in superconducting films offers interesting advantages because there is a lower energy gap. So the energy gap in a superconductor is going from Cooper pairs to quasi-particles. And the typical gap is of order millielectron volt. So this is a potential technology that could reduce our thresholds, theoretically, by three orders of magnitude. This will help with our kinematics problem of trying to detect these lighter mass particles. Now, people have been looking at superconductors as detectors for a while, although people have been very focused on the fact that you can get better energy resolution. Now, this is sort of a second order effect. It goes like the square root of the number of quanta that you detect typically. There's a Fano factor in there sometimes. But you would expect to get at least 30 times better energy resolution with a superconductor detector because there are more quanta. But really, for this talk, the big thing is the lower energy threshold. This goes like the number of quanta. This goes like the band gap. This should be 1,000 times lower than in an ionization detector, theoretically. If you could get down to single quasi-particles, then you would have a milli-EV threshold. And this is a new radiation regime. It's kind of a fun area to think of because this is really an energy space where even people thinking about dark matter, this is the crossover between thinking about it as a particle and thinking about it as a wave. It is sort of in this energy regime. So it's kind of fun to think in this energy regime. So superconductors are ideal for light dark matter searches. And the threshold is potentially below the neutrino mass scale. So if you could think of some way to concentrate those cosmic neutrinos that you're thinking about. So if you have very cold neutrinos, you could stick this detector in there. And this is just I'm showing black body spectra. I'll explain this in a moment. But this is the threshold of a superconductor detector. And this is sort of the mass scales of your neutrinos. So if you could get neutrinos to annihilate at a high enough rate, we could just stick one of these detectors in there and measure the neutrino mass right off the spectrometer.
Yeah, I wish.
Yeah, I guess I am winking at you on that one.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's fun to say that the threshold might be below the neutrino mass. I think that's a new scale, and there could certainly be new physics, because at every mass scale, we certainly seem to see new physics in nature. So at millielectron volts, the backgrounds are going to include all of our known sources, all of our ways of getting dirt in there, but there will be many things that we don't know how to tackle. So this is non-ionizing radiation. And stray fields, those may be the same thing, depending on how you think. But a static electric or magnetic field is a potential background in this energy range. Photons of almost any energy are a background. Vibrations are a big background. Everything you can think of, chemistry is a big background. Neutrino annihilation, I wish, was a background. So here I just show black body spectra. And this is what I was saying earlier. At room temperature, so that's this red curve, this is sort of the EV scale, this black bar. So you can see that with this exponential cutoff that we're all thankful for, there's really not supposed to be a lot of ionization at room temperature, which is nice. We actually have to go to much, much lower energies just to get rid of all the black body radiation that would be a background for these searches. So, you know, anything above 1 Kelvin or so will just be swamped by black body radiation.
How much does this depend on how many quasi-particles can you see at one time? So you can have one photon of milli-V energy or 100 photons of 100 of a milli-V energy that comes in within your response time of your detector.
Yes. So the threshold of your detection technique will certainly as it goes lower, then the lower energy photons will be more of a background.
Yeah, but I'm saying the following. So if you have a response time, there is also the response time of your detector. Let's say it's a picosecond. If in a picosecond I throw 100 photons that have 100 of a milli-V energy versus one photon of milli-V energy, would you be able to tear it apart?
In a picosecond, with modern technology, you could not tell those things apart.
Yeah, but picosecond is a misnomer. So the question is, how much leakage do you have from low and energy stuff that just adds up within your response time to keep?
This is a question that we're actively doing research on to understand the low energy stuff that could be important. Yes, as so the story I'm trying to tell is that as we've done for the 100 GeV WIMP, so we will have to do for the light WIMP. We will have to understand all the sources of background and then understand how to control, mitigate, or remove them. At least from the simple energetics, if you have more energy within the resolving time, so, and the resolving time can vary wildly. There are bolometers where the resolving time is 1 second. There are bolometers, well, there are acoustic phonon sensors where you can get down to, say, 100 microseconds. There are qubits, which I hopefully will get to, where you can actually resolve things much faster. So that is more at the picosecond level, although some of it depends on the signal propagation. You'll be limited by the signal propagation time. So this is our big challenge. Black body radiation is a simple thing to calculate and to show the impact of, but there are many things that store and release energy at the milli-EV scale. And I would say that all of the low threshold dark matter searches, we've all gotten to a point where we have an unknown background that seems to be common between the experiments. So we all observe low energy excesses. This is why Daniel's searching for a new technology, is because of these horrible backgrounds that we're all seeing. But I think it's important, and it really gives impetus to having multiple experiments, multiple techniques to try to understand these backgrounds. So most low temperature results show low energy backgrounds are significant, much more than we would expect from the known sources of ionizing radiation, or at least the ones that we have counted so far. It seems to be decaying over long time scales. So with half-lives on the order of say a month, this is seen at low electron hole counts in CCDs. It's seen in some super CDMS detectors and some other cryogenic detectors as well.
Why does that happen? Because
that is the question we would love to answer. We would love to answer why this is happening and how we can get rid of it. That is the crux of both discovering light dark matter, if it exists, and producing better quantum computers, if that's a thing you want.
So can you explain a bit more? So you build your detector, everything happens at the ground, or do you bring stuff from the surface down?
Everybody builds their detectors on surface, brings the parts underground, and puts it all together to run it. Clearly,
you haven't been able to identify any activation background, because you had it on the surface.
We have identified many cosmogenic activation products. We have strict limits. So, for example, Super CDMS, we just got a tower 2 weekends ago.
Yeah.
They've limited that exposure down to a couple of weeks to keep down tritium levels. But we know of nothing at this 10 EV level in cosmic activation studies, especially something with this sort of half-life. And this is very active research that I've gotten into with these plots. And these plots are all just rate as a function of time. So that's all they are. Just background as a function of time.
So the time scale, is it common for different detectors?
We think it's similar. It's tens of days for all of these different detectors.
Different technology completely, but this tens of days.
Yeah.
And different places, or?
Different places, yes.
So the calorimetrics is like this. So these are like all calorimetrics. For CCDs, we don't know that much because we have terrible timing.
Yeah, yeah. So CCDs, we don't know if the rate.
So these are the backgrounds for the calorimetric detectors, like Super CMS. They are bolometers, essentially. They're really good. And then they see similar-ish timescales, even though many of these bolometers have widely different energy thresholds. And they see
the response time is the same.
Kind of similar-ish.
Different? Like Crest uses scintillating crystals at low temperature. Edelweiss and CDMS are using silicon.
Huh.
It's an intriguing signal, but I would say that my prediction is that low mass dark matter searches are going to be grappling with low energy backgrounds for the next decade.
Yeah, sure, but so.
Sorry, I say simple things.
I mean, yeah, but so does it asymptote to something, like as far as you know, or does it go? I mean, is there a?
It's,
yeah, I think the question, wait, just wait.
Yeah, well, if you just, say this is some unknown thing, if you just wait, and does it go to something that you know?
Yes, yeah, we will do that, but we have to wait for years now, so it's like a full-on experiment.
So if you it's like tens of days, so you have to wait for?
For a year or two.
Yes. Okay.
You need to know that he's
a puzzle. You said that you bring things from the surface when you, generically, but does this happen even if you don't bring things
from
the surface?
Yeah, I was gonna, yeah.
So we're in the middle of trying to answer questions of how reproducible is this? If we bring these to room temperature and back down to millikelvin temperatures, does that reset this effect or not? So we're in the middle of trying to probe those different kinds of questions. But that's sort of active research right now.
Matt Pyle there, the person that is reading there, he will tell you that in his detectors he says stress.
Yeah.
Stress.
Yeah, I was gonna, yeah.
Just
things relaxing. And
yes. Yes.
But it's funny though. But it's funny that different material will have widely different.
At least, but the same time scale. Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, but that stress is very weird that it responds the same. You have different Young modules. You have so different thickness.
How similar
are they detected?
Yeah,
right?
Probably we don't know well enough. They do seem to be seeing similar things, but. We probably don't know. But how similar is the decay time? Like,
yeah, how are they varying by order one, actually?
I don't know. Roughly the same, but.
I have seen pictures of like detectors that, so one of the crash detectors, for instance, they have pictures where they actually look out the detector and they saw the detector was cracked. So it was definitely the fractures of the detector. Some other detectors, they don't see fractures.
Yeah,
but
if it's cracked, I mean, it wouldn't go to zero. It would go into some funny thing, because at the moment it's cracked, that affects the entire response of the thing, right?
If it's cracked, yes, but there are many types of mechanical imperfections.
Yeah, but the moment you have a lot of imperfection, then when things relax in general, you get this type of thing. If you introduce more stress, it wouldn't be going down, it would be going up, because then you would have things stored in the energy stored and would be released at random times.
Yeah, but for instance, one of the hypotheses for this thing is that you're applying just a constant pressure, a constant stress on the crystal.
Yeah.
And there are some mechanical imperfections that are called dislocations.
Yeah, yeah.
They are radiated at a constant rate from impurity sites.
Yeah,
and
but then
you see this plateauing thing. Because you just keep applying the same pressure and these things just radiate away from
the impurities. Then the question is, where did it start? Anyway, let's go. Let's solve this problem now.
Okay. I have 15 minutes left, so let's connect into quantum computing now. So quantum computers are based, sorry, I say things very simply. Quantum computers are based on qubits. Qubits are typically made from low energy systems. Environmental backgrounds are a source of decoherence in qubits, and there are no radiation hard design rules for quantum technologies. So those are some facts that hopefully I will explore a little bit more in the next couple of slides. So they don't call this backgrounds in the quantum computing world. They call this quasi-particle poisoning. So I won't really explain this. And they measure things very strangely. I'm still trying to figure this out. They measure rates of transitions between states all the time instead of measuring things like energy, which I'm more used to. But for probably the same amount of time we've been looking for the 100 GeV WIMP, they've been looking to make quasi-particle densities in aluminum films low enough to make performant qubits for quantum computers. So if you take, for example, this paper from 2018, quasi-particle-induced loss can be responsible for a significant fraction of dissipation in state-of-the-art superconducting qubits. Additionally, we confirmed that hot quasiparticles with a highly excited energy distribution are responsible for the residual excited state population at low temperature in our sample. So the one thing I will point out is that this plot in the lower right, this is the rate of their transitions versus from 1 to 0 and 0 to 1 at low temperature. And they expect these rates to go to zero as you have no more quasiparticles. So the idea is you for these particular qubits, you set them in the first excited state. If a quasiparticle comes by, it can steal some of the energy and transition you to zero. So that's mainly what they've been looking for in some of these, is that you set a qubit in the one state, and you just keep reading it out till you get a zero. And then you've measured a quasiparticle going by stealing that energy. The mismatch between data and experiment at low temperatures is huge. So they see many, many, many orders of magnitude more quasiparticles in low temperature films than one would expect from a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution at these temperatures. And that is the problem they call quasiparticle poisoning of qubits. And I would say my incomplete search of literature says this goes back to 2002, where they've been struggling with this. I will state that we have shown, and I've got some other plots, that ionizing radiation is a piece of this puzzle, but is certainly not all of it. It's about 10% of the problem currently. But if they solve other problems, it will grow, of course, unless they solve this problem as well. And one could imagine, I'm certainly not claiming that, that these hot quasiparticles are from a new component of nature interacting with these superconductors. Probably not, but that has not been disproven. So I like this slide. It's a little bit old now. It's from 2021.
I mean, these are surface things, right? I mean, they are on the surface. So I would imagine that if they have such rates that they affect their tiny little thing, would you have something that...
There are no constraints.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I know that something came out formally. Yeah, by the letter of the law, you are correct. But I mean, these are on the surface, right?
So I'll show some dark matter limits based on that concept later. Okay. And you can see where it is compared to, say, some of the astrophysical constraints.
Okay.
So yeah, but that are taken,
on the surface.
You're getting ahead of my talk. That's the project we just got funded with the Institute for Quantum Computing. Yeah. Okay, so to continue this story, I've got some nice references here. That's why I like to show this plot. Laura Cardani has been doing a lot of great work at Gran Sasso. She's actually run some of these underground at Gran Sasso and been able to show impacts. They're not as well shielded as the infrastructure we have at Snow Lab. So the infrastructure at Snow Lab is much better, actually, for this kind of research. But so they have shown that it's already limiting the coherence. It was more of a 10% effect, if you look at that paper, than a dramatic, we've reduced things by orders of magnitude in terms of the coherence times. Radioactivity limits quantum error correction as well. So let me see. Yes, as I will explain later, ionizing radiation itself certainly leads to correlated errors across large substrates. That is the basis of super CDMS technology. And they were able to show slight improvements by suppressing the radioactivity. A lot of that is done with just resonators rather than qubits, but they certainly show they can produce better quality superconducting films, better resonators, if they limit the radioactivity impinging on these. So they've done both. They've added radioactivity and shown that it decreases the coherence time, and they've removed radioactivity showing that it can nominally increase the coherence times.
Is this mainly, quasi-particle poisoning, is the main problem of current quantum computing devices? Is what's setting their computing performance?
Yes, although the source of that, they believe right now, is two-level system noise, but yes. And this is one of the reasons, these difficulties with quasi-particles was one of the reasons they went from charge qubits to transmon qubits, why they're continuing to search for new qubit technologies to try to get out of this quasi-particle issue. So, as I said before, super CDMS detectors are an experimental demonstration of superconducting circuits exhibiting correlated errors from ionizing radiation. So that's a fancy way of saying they're superconducting radiation detectors, but in the language of quantum computing.
Yeah, but may I ask you, so about the previous, this noise that they have? Well, the noise that you had, you know, like in the dark matter detectors, this one decreases with time. So the one they have, does it change with time or it's kind of constant?
There is one paper that I think was from 22, where it says they're seeing a similar time decrease in the quasi-particle rates.
Oh, I see.
So I think, don't hold me to this, but I'm pretty sure we're studying the same background right now already. Yeah. That is the basis of this talk.
Naive question. So I understand why we do this with dark matter. Do they need to use this such low energy system for quantum computers? I don't know. Maybe just like,
That's where they see the most robust quantum effects in systems is down at these milli EVs, although there is a question, right? I mean, photon quantum computers are not sensitive to this problem, clearly. But then if you look at the detectors they use, which I know you all know about, the single photon counting superconducting nanowires, we believe those are limited by cosmic radiation as well. So if you build up a huge array of nanowires, you will be limited by cosmic radiation, by radiation in general. I don't know if you can find a good, robust quantum system at higher energies. People are talking about changing the metal they use. We could talk about that in a bit, but that will affect the energy scale at some level. But back to super CDMS. So the way ionizing radiation interacts with this superconducting circuit is we have a transition edge sensor, and it is connected to a piece of superconducting aluminum. So there are two superconducting elements. There's a phonon collector, and then this is connected to the tungsten TES. So these, we cover the surface of the detector with as much superconducting aluminum as possible, and then we try to funnel the quasi-particles that are created in the aluminum by connecting them to a lower temperature superconductor with a lower gap. So the gap, like once you've thermalized down to this energy of a gap, you cannot create these quasi-particles anymore. You've gone below that energy scale, and that's sort of why the quasi-particles get tunneled into this lower temperature superconductor. The TES is a device that goes from some normal resistance down to nominally no resistance. There's a transition temperature. And we keep our tungsten right on the transition edge. That way, a small change in temperature, a small number of quasi-particles going into this tungsten film warming it up, will cause a large change in resistance, which we can read out. So that's the basic detection technique. So what we've done, especially when we put a high voltage across the detector, is we, you know, ionizing radiation will come in and interact with the bulk of the silicon. Electron and holes will be created and drifted, both from the initial interaction and from drifting of electrons and holes, you will create heat. And it is that heat that you want to measure. So first you get very high energy phonons that are very localized, but very quickly they will decay into optical phonons that have a wavelength the size of the detector. So they will be impinging upon the entire surface of the detector, reflecting around. They get absorbed by all of the superconductor on the surface, and then we read them out. especially with high voltage, I have personally been able to get ionizing radiation to saturate every TES on the detector. So in a 75 millimeter crystal or even 100 millimeter crystal, I can get all of the superconductor to go to its normal resistance. That is a correlated error if you put this in context of quantum computing. Every single qubit will go normal, so it will no longer store any of the information from your quantum computation. And so background rate, at least in this limit where it's going to make everything go normal, translates, and in general, it translates to a fundamental limit on the computation time you'll have in a quantum computer. So you may be able to do a quantum computation for 1 second on the surface, and underground you could do it for 10,000 seconds, which could be a big advantage. Now, what does this look like in, say, a Google Sycamore chip, a cutting-edge qubit chip? So this is a pretty new paper.
So this cosmic ray lab that you have, I mean, it's what, muon? What was that, actually?
This was underground, so this was more of a MeV photon, 300 keV photon.
Where from?
Radioactive barium source that I put near the detector.
Ah, so I mean, you grew up it by hand.
Okay, so this is a paper done by the Santa Barbara group working with Google, or they are the Google theory department. I don't fully understand. So the idea here was, as I was saying, they could set all of their qubits to one, look for transitions to zero, and call that an error. If you have correlated errors, then you will see more than one of your qubits go to zero. So the experiment from this paper from last year was to take a cutting-edge quantum processor and look for correlated errors. So you can see the number of errors, and there were basically 24 qubits on this chip. So you can see that the number of correlated errors goes to a maximum number that they can see all of the qubits are giving errors at a specific period of time, and then that decays away, much as you would expect the heat from ionizing radiation events to go away. In super CDMS, this is what we would have predicted and guessed. They seemed very surprised. The title of this paper has something about catastrophic errors in the title. And they even have the timing resolution. They can see the correlated errors sort of propagate across the crystal as the phonons start to grow and propagate across the crystal. So that's kind of fun. So that's a radiation detector in trying to disguise itself as a quantum computer. So the project at SnowLab. So we host the lowest background millikelvin test facility on the planet, as far as I know. So this is a dilution refrigerator. And I've got another slide that shows some of the details. Deep inside a shield, under 2 kilometers of the Canadian shield, designed to test low mass dark matter experiments and detector technologies in a very low radiation environment. So it has about a factor of 10,000 reduction from surface background grades. This isn't the best they do in dark matter experiments, but the idea for this facility was to be able to turn it around in a week, to be able to put a new device, some new technology inside the fridge, and cool it back down inside the shielding within a week, which we are able to do. It also has radiation sources, so we can bring radiation in, see how it impacts the quantum devices, dark matter detectors or quantum computers, and then we can remove it. The reduction in muons is about 50 million, so about 10 to the 8. So they are no longer in this laboratory, and we don't have a muon source, unfortunately. Just to see some of the technologies involved. So there's a dilution refrigerator. These have magnetic shielding. I'm learning that we don't have enough magnetic shielding compared to what people do for quantum devices, and so we will have to improve the magnetic shielding itself. This is inside a water shield, but we didn't want to put the dilution refrigerator in water, so we built a dry well. There's a deck above that people can stand on and muck with the electronics as they're trying to get stuff to work. We have low activity lead that makes up a bulk of the lead that we have. We also have very low activity lead, so I don't know if you know, but radon itself decays into lead-210, which has a half-life of 20 years, and it's really annoying to wait for that to decay. So, and if you smelt lead, it'll have this lead-210 in it. You know, you'd have to do isotopic separation to get rid of it. So we just get really old lead, like that's been sitting at the bottom of the ocean for a while, for very low activity lead. We have lead inside the dilution refrigerator. This has a decent amount of heat capacity, so it lengthens our cool down time to about 3 days. And then we have polyethylene plastic up on top to stop neutrons. The water stops neutrons coming from the sides, but to stop neutrons coming from the top, we have polyethylene. And then we also have an active suspension system. There's a motor in modern dilution refrigerators, and so we decouple that motor from the rest of the mechanical system. There's actually a heat exchanger that just has metal pieces that exchange heat through the gas that's near these metal fingers to make sure that all these parts up above are not actually touching anything down below. And the system's active to get rid of some of the lower frequency vibrations that go on. And we have a gamma ray source that can travel up a tube and a neutron source that can travel through a tube. Okay, and as I just mentioned, Professor Chris Wilson at the Institute for Quantum Computing is the project leader on a project that was just chosen for funding by the US Army Research Office. So the US Army is gonna fund quantum computing research in Snow Lab through Waterloo. Chalmers University will produce the cutting edge superconducting qubit arrays. They'll be tested in Sweden at Chalmers, then here at Waterloo, and then they'll come to Snow Lab. So we wanted to reproduce the performance at these two surface facilities before we take them underground to test them. Now, this is very new. If you post these slides online, I'll probably take out the US Army Research Office part just because we're working with them on publicity. We haven't actually signed a contract yet. We've just started about contracting. So that's how early the project is, but we're very excited about this one. Right. So just sort of in conclusion on that, I'm running out of time. I think the milli-EV backgrounds are really what entangles particle detection with quantum computing. And it brings us back. So quantum systems, like these qubits, are sensitive to radiation from the environment and very low levels, right? Single quasi-particles they're sensitive to. And particle physics researchers are gaining an understanding of modern quantum systems by collaborating on backgrounds. And new detector concepts are coming based on these collaborations. So I just put up a couple of concepts. This is certainly not an exhaustive list, and I apologize if I've missed your favorite concept or the papers that you've been writing. I'm sure I did. But milli-EV energy detection, it's a theoretical and experimental challenge that people are tackling actively. And I think the quantum 2.0 technologies are enabling new detection concepts. You know, optically levitated sensors, I like that concept. There's been a number of papers on various condensed matter systems as well as superconducting nanowires. It's a very active field, and there are a lot of interesting ideas that are inexpensive to prototype. So it's kind of a fun time. And then there's another paper, which is really quite interesting. This one's newer, just came up at the end of last year. So this is trying to push this concept of qubits as single quasi-particle detectors, and to say, okay, what are the implications on dark matter densities, dark matter interaction strengths at low masses, now that we have a detector that's capable of seeing single quasi-particles? So effectively, this has a milli-EV threshold already. And indeed, you can see that this...
Sorry. But I think, yeah, that bound, I think it's missing some exclusions.
You think this plot here is...
Yeah, I'm afraid so. It's Maxime's inflection thing. It goes... It's on the surface, and it's unshielded. I mean, there is an idea by Maxime Postpelov, and I think there may be other stuff too, where dark matter falls towards the sun, reflected backwards. I mean, these are huge cross-sections.
Oh, yeah.
These are huge cross-sections. So the flux of backscattering dark matter, so huge, I think, that whole thing is gone.
Yeah, and that's what this blue curve is actually, I mean, it's just showing that the cross sections are very large. So this is dark matter that thermalizes with the Earth because the cross section is so high.
I don't know how you can translate that. Yeah. So anyway,
But for this is for the halo. So just for dark matter in the halo.
Yeah, but I think that is, I mean, if that cross section was so large, I don't think that's,
I agree, the cross-sections are still large. And this isn't carving out new parameter space, even if you just take these Lyman alpha and satellite bounds on dark matter.
Yeah, so.
But this is the first time, they weren't even trying to do a dark matter measurement. And it shows that if we are able to reduce the quasi-particle background.
It's like tap dancing snakes, right? It's not that they do it well, it's that they do it at all.
Exactly.
I mean, most likely you will be doing a detector that's actually designed to do this. You won't take a quantum computer to look.
Yes.
For
yes.
I mean, between you and me.
No, I agree. I agree. And here's one way to do that. So this is really an integral detector. This just detects a rate. This is a Geiger counter. You get a click when you get a quasi-particle that goes by. Here I include a plot. I also worked on Ku and Pico, the bubble chamber dark matter experiments. And I show that this is the same. This is a threshold detector. You set a threshold and you get a bubble. So that's all you get. You get no energy information if you ignore the acoustics. But for this plot from 2008, there was no energy information. So all they did was they operated the detector with a variety of thresholds. So you can see the energy here in terms of threshold and the energy threshold in terms of pressure down here. You can see the shapes as you change the threshold of an integral detector, how the shapes of the rates should change as a function of threshold if you're detecting dark matter versus a monochromatic spectrum where you just get the same answer until you get above the energy of the monochromatic spectrum and then you get nothing. So this is like integrating a Dirac function. You'll get one until you get past zero, and then you get zero. And so that's why you get a flat spectrum and a drop-off, because this is a monochromatic spectrum from alpha decay. So that's how the bubble chamber showed that alpha decays were their primary background. And that was correct. They removed the alphas, and this background went down dramatically. So you can do the same thing with these similar qubit technologies. If you have something sensitive to single quasi particles, then one can change the threshold. For example, by using different metals. You could have the same device, you could have different metals, and then you can form bands, much as they do in optical astronomy. You could have your 42 micro EV to 0.4 milli EV band, and you could subtract everything above 0.4 milli EV from the rate in this detector. And the same with the rest of these. And this, say this 3 milli EV band gap, you could use that to subtract all of the backgrounds above 3 milli EV. Given that the rates are so high in these detectors, background subtraction should be very effective.
Up to some point, I mean, do you have any feel how well, like when you have a non-zero background, when you try to subtract it, I mean, How much, you have to know it, but how well would you know it to do it properly? Do you have a feel? I mean,
I have no idea.
Do you have intuition at all?
Background
subtraction? Because right now, from what I understand, so current detectors, like the high threshold ones, how much of a background subtraction do they do?
They do very little background subtraction. Yeah. They do profile likelihood analysis, so they do some, but it's very little.
Yeah, but now, so you have, you don't have a feel. Like, I'm asking a very subjective question. How does your intuition tell you how well, like?
In the dark matter field, we've typically been able to get a couple of orders of magnitude before systematics start to kick in.
Yeah.
I would point to something like the cosmic microwave background of seeing tiny fluctuations on a on a steady background. The rates are much higher there, so there is hope here that we could do better just because the rates are higher.
I see.
But we do need to understand the background to subtract it
yeah.
at some level. Or we can understand that, you know, for particular dark matter masses, they're not going to create signals above 3 milliEV, say. So you could just reject everything above that and take any excess power here.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone looked back at Tama, for example? Because that was a to see, to get intuition from that.
From Dama?
Yeah, because that was a, I keep the kitchen sink background experiment, right? It was no.
And they show some of the difficulties. I mean, people have even shown that the way they do their data analysis can introduce modulations that way.
But they are, so Sensei is thinking in doing background subtraction for instance now for the next run. They are starting to think, but it's a new thing. It's now nobody subtracts anything because they don't understand the background.
Yeah.
Now they are starting to understand, and they are going.
Okay.
They are thinking in doing background subtraction.
But how do you assign systematic errors?
Yeah, this is not.
This is what I don't understand about it.
Because there are error bars to hear. It's just.
Unless you know what your background is.
But sometimes you know that backgrounds in a higher energy beam, it's coincidences from lower energy beams. So for instance, if you have two low energy events, that it's equivalent to one high energy event. So that you can subtract. If you measure the low energy event background, then you just know that you're just going to have coincidences. And then you subtract that, for instance. That's one possibility. It's in data, so.
Like a side bend.
So it is related, not exactly the same, but it's, for instance, that's just one example, when you have coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
You know that then, it's a purely combinatorial question, when will it affect high energy beams, and then you can do backward subtraction.
So yes, I'm not saying this is easy, even just building qubits out of new metals. Luckily, this is something they're actually doing, tantalum qubits is one metal they're trying to produce qubits in. If they're able to get those fabs going, then we could test things like this. I'm not sure these are the right metals. But anyway, it's a concept of actually building a spectrometer down at these micro EV, milli EV energies that could allow you to start to get a handle on the energy spectrum at these faint energies. Anyway, so I will conclude. In conclusion, light, dark matter, and quantum computing researchers are in a correlated superposition of research outcomes. After we finish this research, which may take a decade or more, you all have been asking the good questions that we're trying to answer, either dark matter will have been detected, and it will be a fundamental limit to quantum device performance, or we will have improved the performance of quantum devices, but we won't have discovered the nature of dark matter. And so we have very correlated outcomes at the end of this research. And SnowLab is the best place to perform this measurement. So, thank you.